This is New Beginnings, hosted by award-winning broadcaster and speaker Freddie Bell. A program for and about America's 78 million baby boomers. Here's your host, Freddie Bell.
Hey everyone, welcome to New Beginnings. I'm Freddie Bell. Coming up on the show today, we'll talk to you about the challenge of changing careers. We'll speak with Elizabeth Ebalt. She is the Vaccine Equity Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. We'll also talk about Super Bowl dishes with one of my favorite chefs. This week, we'll also help you to save money and energy. We'll tell you how, and we'll give you our week in review. This is New Beginnings, and our show starts right now. If you like sports like I do, you know that the Super Bowl is coming in just a couple of weeks. And as you sit around watching the big game, there can be a lot of food passing forth. We talked to Chef Renee. She'll tell you about some of her favorite dishes and how you can make that big game menu even more exciting. Chef Melanie Reed, who's our at-home chef and food enthusiast, is there a less expensive way to enjoy the game at home when it comes to food?
Yes, there sure is. I love to create a really wonderful platter for game day. So I have some great go-tos to share and a few hosting tips as well.
Wow. So can you share, before we get there, can you share some fun facts about the Super Bowl or the big game, as people call it?
Absolutely. You know, the biggest sports football day of the year is coming up in just a couple of weeks, and it's actually the second largest food day during the year as well, right behind Thanksgiving, of course. Most Americans double their daily calories on game day, and of course we do. You know, food brings people together, and, you know, it's just wonderful to have snacks all day while we watch the big game. It's a big day for beer, too. Americans consume 325 million gallons of beer during the game.
Gosh.
Can you believe that?
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
So can you give us an idea, an easy, convenient way or some food options for that Sunday when everybody is watching and gathering around the television set?
Absolutely. So I love to create a platter, a nice spread with a lot of different kinds of snacks because it's a big day for grazing and just having a little bit here and there. So what I like to do is I set up a charcuterie board with my cheese and salamis, and I like to have a variety. I love baguettes, so I like to choose Julian's Recipe baguettes because they're really authentic and wholesome. They're made with real European butter, and it's really easy. I take it out of the freezer, throw it in the oven, and it's ready to go in just about 10 minutes. And it's just, they have some really nice flavors, a butter and garlic flavor, or you could get a truffle butter variety. So I like to have the Julian's Recipe baguettes with my cheese and my salami. And I like to have a gluten-free option for my dips. So I like to choose pork rinds, and because they're a low fat or a low carb, excuse me, and a high protein option that makes a good dipper for salsa and hummus and whatever dips you have. I like Southern Recipe small batch pork rinds because they have really great flavors like spicy dill and chili cheese, and just a lot of great options.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, I was going to say, I like to keep something around that's a little more substantial for the people who are really hungry. So that's when I choose a sandwich. And I like to use Rayburn sandwiches because they're really quick and convenient, right out of the freezer, 90 seconds in the microwave. They've got a delicious Philly cheesesteak and a lot of different options. So it's just quick and easy, and the less time I have to spend cooking, the more time I can spend enjoying the game, right?
Is there a quick recipe that you can share?
Sure, absolutely. What I love to do is make a bruschetta because it's really simple. I just chop up some tomatoes, some onion, some fresh basil, and a little bit of olive oil. If you want some garlic, you can put some garlic in there. And I just stir it together in a bowl. And then this goes really well with a toasted baguette, and it's nice and easy because you can have your baguettes, you can have your bruschetta in a bowl, and just spoon it right on top. It's delicious.
Do you put out things like the logo of the different teams, or placemats or anything like that? Do you suggest anything like that to dress it up a little bit?
Oh, yeah, I love to get festive with my decorations. You know, if I can find logoed gear, I definitely use it. It's also fun to just, like, find the team colors and then put up streamers, balloons with your team's colors and just really get festive with it. I love to do that.
All right. This is Chef Melanie Reed, at home chef and food enthusiast. Do you have a final thought for us this morning to make the Super Bowl watching even more fun?
You know, have fun with it. I like to, you know, make sure I have food options for everybody. I've got, my mom is gluten-free, and my sister's kind of picky, so I like to keep a variety around. And don't hold back, because like I said, it's one of the biggest food days of the year, so just really take this opportunity to indulge and have a great time.
All right. Can't thank you enough. How can we get more information?
Absolutely. Well, you can find Rayburn sandwiches at Dollar General. My favorite baguette Julian's recipe is at Whole Foods. And my favorite pork rind Southern recipe small batch are at Cost Plus World Market. And you can learn more about me on Instagram at Food Influencer Central.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Okay. We'll talk soon.
All right. Take care.
You're listening to New Beginnings. New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Hi, everyone, and I've got some ideas for you this weekend on how you can save some money and energy with smart home devices. I love technology, and smart home devices don't just make it easier to close the garage door or secure your home. They can also help you in saving money and energy if you use them properly. And seeing as how Americans spend $130 billion a year on wasted energy, people can use all the help they can get. And my job this weekend is to help you to get there. You can set up smart home devices using a smartphone, and you can control them remotely, put them on a schedule, connect them to a smart speaker, and even set them up to perform actions on their own. By giving you more control over the things in your home that use energy, smart home devices can be part of an energy-saving program. I've got a few ways you can use smart home devices to cut down on energy and water waste while also saving money. Here is the first of four. Number one, turn off the lights. When somebody in my house leaves the lights on, I can almost feel the energy bill just going up and up and up. And maybe it's just my blood pressure. I don't know. But smart lighting foils energy hogs by adding remote control, scheduling, and automation to an everyday fixture. For example, smart bulbs are the simplest way to save money. Why? Because all you have to do is screw in a light bulb. And all smart bulbs are LED bulbs, which use at least 75% less energy than incandescents, yet last 25 times longer. They also bring extra savings by adding dimming, which can save another 40%. Smart bulbs can trigger reaction to other smart devices, motion sensors, or your location, also known as geofencing, so they'll operate efficiently without you having to turn them off. Another option for the person who knows how to wire an outlet is a smart in-wall light switch, which replaces your existing light switch to control lighting fixtures. If you're clinging to those bulbs and switches you already own, a smart plug tackles the same on-off function and scheduling functions for lamps and small appliances, and you can still add regular money-saving LED bulbs. A smart plug offers an inexpensive way to control lights. I'm trying to help you to save your money with some energy-efficient ideas and smart home devices. And these devices don't need permanent installation either, so you can take them down whenever you move. Number two, you can stop water leaks. According to the EPA, everyday household leaks account for about a trillion gallons of wasted water every year. That's equivalent to over 1,500 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Adding a smart leak sensor is an easy way to monitor under the sinks, behind toilets, around washing machines, and other potentially leaky points. When the sensor detects a leak, it sends a smartphone alert so you can tend to the issue before things get out of hand. If you want more comprehensive control, or if you have a second home, the Flow by Moen and the Thin Plus are smart water valves that install on your water main and can sense and alert you to leaks as small as a drippy faucet. When they detect a pipe burst or a cycling toilet, they can turn off the water to prevent a catastrophe. Smart sprinkler controllers can also control waterways outside by regulating the amount you use to irrigate your lawn or garden based on your specific soil moisture and even plant types. If you don't have an in-ground sprinkler system, a smart faucet controller works for a standard sprinkler or even for soaker hoses. Idea number three is to control temperatures. The U.S. Energy Information Administration says that the largest single use of electricity by United States households is in fans and air conditioning, with some households spending more than $525 a year. A smart thermostat optimizes your home's heating and cooling so that you never waste electricity or fuel. There are a number of thermostats that help you so that when you leave home, it can adjust the temperature so you aren't blasting the air conditioning or the heat all day long. And it turns the system back on before you get home, so in the summer, you don't arrive to an oven and regret being energy conscious. If you don't have central air, either a smart air conditioner or a standard window unit with a smart plug can give you additional control so you're not wasting cool air when no one is home to appreciate it. A smart ceiling fan can be another great option. The U.S. Department of Energy says ceiling fans let you raise thermostats about 4 degrees without noticing a difference. And smart fans, like those from Hunter, include motion sensors, so they run only when you're in the room. And they can also integrate with a thermostat to maximize savings. And if a ceiling fan just isn't a good fit for you, a room fan with a smart plug can be an easy and affordable option as well. Did you know that a lot of heat passes through windows, resulting in overheating in the summer and heat loss in the winter? Shades can help prevent that, but smart shades, although expensive to install, make it easier. Set either at specific times or on schedules, smart shades and blinds by companies such as Hunter Douglas can open and close to allow light and energy to pass through only when you want it. And finally, conserve energy use. There are many electrical appliances and gadgets, including computer speakers, televisions, coffee makers, and more, and they continue to draw energy even when they're not in use. That's a phenomenon referred to as phantom or vampire energy. According to a 2016 article in the New York Times, the annual tally for all of these vampires is the equivalent of 50 large power plants worth of electricity. Smart plugs, like the ones that we told you about, can monitor in real time the energy use of any device that you plug in. And finally, if you need to power several things, you can try a smart power strip like the TP-Link, which can track up to 6 devices individually. All you have to do is just plug in whichever energy hog you wish, like your old plasma television, an audio system, a space heater, and schedule the strip to cut the power completely when the device isn't in use. The individual cost savings won't be dramatic, but along with other energy savings, they do add up. I'm trying to help you to save money this weekend and energy with smart home devices. Turn off the lights, stop the water leaks, control your temperatures, and conserve energy use. I'm Freddie Bell, and we have more to come right here on New Beginnings. This is New Beginnings, and on the way, we talk with Elizabeth Ebolt from the Minnesota Department of Health. She is talking about incentives to get the younger children vaccinated.
You're listening to New Beginnings.
New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Hello again, everybody, and we continue our program right now, and we turn our attention to the virus, the pandemic, and with us to help us through this conversation this morning is the Vaccine Outreach Director for the Minnesota Department of Health, Elizabeth Ebolt. She has been with us through thick and thin throughout the last several months, and I want to say a couple of years, talking about how we can protect ourselves and even the youngest with us. Good morning and welcome back to the program, and Happy New Year. It's the first time we've spoken this year.
That's right. Happy New Year. Glad to be here.
Glad you're with us. Talk about the Kids Deserve a Shot program. I understand that's been reactivated.
That's right. It's a quite popular program that we had going throughout 2021, and we brought it back for 2022. This time for our even younger among us, our 5 to 11 year old. So the program is still making available a $200 Visa gift card for children ages 5 to 11 who received their first and second doses of the Pfizer vaccine between January 1st of this year and February 28th. So to qualify, again, you must be at least 5 years old at the time of one or both of your shots and must be 11 years old or younger at the time of your first shot. So families can receive one $200 Visa gift card per each eligible 5 to 11-year-old vaccinated in their family between that time range. And for more information, you know, you can go online to our MDH website, certainly to register, or you can call our COVID public hotline at 833-431-2053 Monday through Saturday. And so we're very excited about this. One thing to note is that unlike the last time we ran this program, we had a college scholarship drawing that happened simultaneously. That is still going to happen just later this spring. So that's something we can all look forward to.
I know that aspect of it was really, really popular. Our phones rang off the hook. Our email was hot with students looking for more information about that.
Totally. It will be back. So just look forward to that.
Let's continue talking with children. Everyone, we have Elizabeth Ebalt with us. She is the Vaccine Outreach Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. Earlier this week, emergency use authorization of the vaccine by Pfizer for children 6 months to 5 years old was pushed through. What does that mean for Minnesotans and the youngest among us?
Yes, this is obviously very big news this week coming from the federal government, coming from Pfizer. It's great news, too, because we've been looking forward to vaccinating this age group for many months now, especially as we've been seeing the Delta and Omicron variants affect children and unfortunately seeing some of them suffering serious reactions, ending up hospitalized. So a pediatric vaccine for the youngest among us is being welcomed by certainly us in public health and by so many families. So what this means, there's kind of a unique component to this authorization process that's different for our older children. And that's because of some of the clinical trials that came out of Pfizer at the end of last year, 2021, for this age group. So what they found is that for children 6 months to 2 years old, the lower two-dose vaccine series they have been using worked great. It generated the kind of immune response they wanted to see. But in kids 2 to 4 years old, that two dose appeared insufficient. That immune response was less than what it should be. And so the result was, you know, these kids would likely require a third shot as part of their initial vaccine series. So what we're expecting is that Pfizer, you know, is going to go ahead with this emergency use authorization for two doses for kids ages 6 months to, you know, just under five, so 4 years old, with the expectation that by the time their clinical trials on this third dose for the 2 to 4 year olds are complete, then they can apply for another EUA and begin administering those third doses for the 2 to 4 year olds at that time. So like I said, it's a little bit of a unique approach and, you know, it's a little different, but really ultimately it's because of the need for this pediatric vaccine for this age group and just wanting to make sure we get that available to families and children, obviously, yes, safely, but also quickly. So if all goes as planned, really, you know, we could see the two dose series for this 6 month to 4 year old age group authorized as early as the end of February.
Wow. So that means that shots could be in arms as early as mid-March?
It's very possible with that timeline, which is certainly ahead of what we had been talking about up until this point, which, again, is great news.
I'm sorry, Elizabeth Ebalt with us. I was going to say Miss Vaccine with us today. Elizabeth Ebalt with us this morning, the Vaccine Outreach Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. Let's talk about, we also saw in the news this week about new pills or pills that have been, I just call it, this is Freddie's term, supercharged, that you can take this and you can gain some type of immunity. I'm just curious, there's been a lot of buzz about that. Why are people more excited about the pill rather than the vaccine itself?
Yes. Well, you know, Freddie, I've been called worse, so I'll take Miss Vaccine. But as far as these new pills, you know, we've been seeing this throughout the pandemic response. You know, we've been seeing some, you know, great research and development that's been going on. And I think that, you know, with all of these new developments and with all these new fixes, you know, there's just been so much added baggage around the vaccines. Mm-hmm. You could even say political baggage around the vaccines from when they launched, and, you know, everything from masking as well, you know, removing it from a real true public health space. And so I think sometimes the buzz around these new pills is because those operate a bit outside of this baggage that I'm talking about, that the vaccines and maskings have suffered from. But what we do know, I'll say, is that ultimately our vaccines, our boosters really do, they're the best armor, the best protection we have, masking that we have against the variant that we are going through now and all the variants that have developed up until this point. Mm-hmm. And so that continues to be the primary objective for, you know, moving us ahead in a safe and effective way.
It seems as if the variant has a mind of its own. Just as soon as we seem to see numbers decreasing for the Omicron variant, another variant shows its face. Do we have the protection with the different vaccines that will, I'll say, just give us the armor of protection against subsequent viruses that could come out? Are we protected enough for the different variants that could come out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that one thing that we, you know, as a public health department, as, you know, coming from the federal government on down, that we've really tried to remind everyone of since the onset of all this is that new variants are to be expected. We shouldn't be afraid of when we hear about a new variant coming about, because that's to be expected with a virus like this. Mm-hmm. By now, of course, we're all familiar with the original variant, with Delta, with Omicron that we're suffering right now. And many of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard about this new Omicron subvariant. You can think of it as almost like a close cousin of Omicron that has recently been detected.
Yes.
And what we do know about that is that, to put in context, okay, so at the end of January, this new subvariant accounted for 8% of known COVID cases in the U.S., and none of those had been found in Minnesota yet. Okay, so that's not yet a dominant variant that we're worrying about. In places where it has become a dominant variant, the subvariant has become the dominant variant, dominant strain, researchers are showing that, okay, well, it's about 1.5 times more transmissible than the original strain, and it doesn't appear to be more severe, and it doesn't appear that people are ending up in the hospital more. And so what they are seeing, though, is that when you do have the protection of your vaccine, of your booster, you remain, you know, effective protection from those very important things, right, which are hospitalization and death. So consistently, what we've seen with these vaccines we have on the market is that with each new strain, although they have been severe and we have been experiencing some very trying times and our hospitals are stressed out, we do see that for those of us that are vaccinated, we are staying out of the hospital and our lives are still here and, you know, and we're still alive. And so that's what we know has been working, and we can feel really good about that going forward.
Let's leave it on a positive note. Thank you so much. That's Elizabeth Ebalt. She is the Vaccine Outreach Director for the Minnesota Department of Health, and this is New Beginnings. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All Minnesotans age 12 and older who got the Pfizer vaccine should get a booster shot at least 5 months after their second dose. People aged 12 to 17 can also receive the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine as their booster dose. To find a vaccine or a booster for your child, visit mn.gov/vaxforkids or check with your healthcare provider or pharmacy, or watch for vaccination clinics being offered at schools or other community locations near you. This message from the Minnesota Department of Health.
In today's world, we really need words of encouragement. Introducing Words to the Wise by Freddie Bell. Let your mind be opened by the wisdom of thought. Let the inspiration of the words feed your mind, body, and spirit. Regardless of the issues you face each day, Words to the Wise by Freddie Bell can help you power through. Words to the Wise by Freddie Bell, a handy reference. Available on Amazon, FreddieBell.com, and Barnes & Noble.
Our show features the concerns of America's 78 million baby boomers in employment, finance, health and nutrition, and even entertainment. Every day is a chance for a fresh start.
You're listening to New Beginnings. New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Hi, everyone. I'm Freddie Bell, and now it's time to talk finance with Libel Sternbach. Libel is an Amazon best-selling author of Living with Financial Anxiety and Authenticity. Libel, welcome back to New Beginnings. How are you this week?
Hey, how are you doing today?
So, Libel, let's pick up on that discussion where we started last week. We've been talking about inflation and the inflation scare. And Libel, if you don't mind, you said there are two types of inflation. There's a good inflation and then there's a bad inflation.
Yeah. So there's inflation during our working years, right? Where that's good for us and it increases our economy. It encourages us to buy things and it encourages when employment is low and inflation is at the right level, businesses grow and our wages increase. However, in retirement, unless we do something that allows us to mimic the growth that we would have from our wages, it is a deadly killer to our retirement.
Everyone, we're talking with Libel today, and we're talking about inflation. I have a question here from Richard, and he's asking, how do you plan to cope with inflation throughout your retirement, especially if you're on plan to retire early? Now, even though I have a pension, he says, even though I have a pension, it will never increase. Social Security provides some relief, but more is needed. He says, I will use dividends from a couple of stocks and interest from bond funds currently being reinvested. But he says that may not be enough. Even though the 4% withdrawal strategy contains an inflation component, he is wondering, Libel, is that enough? And is it safe for the future if higher inflation persists? Big question.
Very big question. And there's got a lot of loaded parts to that question. So let's break it apart, right? So the first thing, pension. The pension is not, it doesn't increase. And that's something that you want to be aware of in general is one of the ways that companies and governments kind of reduce benefits and reduce their liability is by removing these little features that you don't really know what they are until you need them. And so not increasing your pension with inflation means that the company gets to have a fixed amount that they have saved away, and they don't have to worry what happens to the economy, which is actually why most pensions went bust after the 70s. We had hyperinflation, and they were speculating with their investment assets. And so they went bust in the 80s. And then we had 401ks came out and IRAs came out as a result of that. So the fact that his pension isn't increasing, that's a problem, right? But it's something that he should have known about beforehand, right? Because that is kind of their nature. Now we have Social Security. And remember what I said about that the government likes to play games to give us less benefits and we don't realize it until we need it. Well, Social Security has something called cost of living adjustments, also known as COLA. And that, in theory, is supposed to increase our benefits in line with inflation, right? So that whatever we were retired at, we would be able to still buy the same goods and services the first day of retirement to the last day of retirement. In theory, great. There's just two problems with that.
Okay.
Number one, Social Security, those adjustments are done a year later, right? So they look at what inflation was the previous year. The problem is you've already paid all of that inflation in that year, right? This past year, we had 7% inflation. You were paying that at the grocery store. You were paying that in utilities. You were paying that in your rent, right? It doesn't help that the next year you get a bump. Your savings already took a 7% hit that it wasn't planning on. And because of the compounding nature of our investments, right, what happens is we need our money to grow at a certain rate. And if we take a 7% greater deduction from that money, right, if we reduce our value by 7% more in 1 year than what we were planning on, that can throw off that entire plan. So that's a serious problem, right? The other thing is this is a little trick that Congress has played on us to keep the cost of Social Security down and still tell people, no, we're still paying out Social Security. Social Security will never go away. They changed what inflation number COLA is based on. So COLA used to be based on the Consumer Price Index urban dwellers inflation. So what normal people had for inflation. Instead, they changed it to exclude what are called the volatile prices, which is energy, food, medicine, the things that really change in value dramatically. So what ends up happening is, well, yeah, you get a cost of living adjustment. It's not reflective of the actual inflation that you're experiencing, right? So it becomes critically important that you have things like stocks and bonds that are paying market rates. And it's important that they're paying market rates because the market is going to have inflation baked in there, right? Except for right now in the bond market, which we can, if we have some time, we can talk about. But the generally speaking, the bonds will pay at least inflation because investors are not going to give you their money and get less money back, right? Mm-hmm. They want to be compensated for that risk, and inflation is one of those risks. So you need to have enough of your money in the market so that it grows with inflation, right? Very important.
So how do I diversify? How do I make sure that I have the right pools of money or pockets of money in these buckets so that I'm really bobbing and weaving as inflation goes up and down?
So there are a number of ways that you can protect yourself against inflation, right? One thing that we talked about was that the stock market is the greatest hedge. And it really is. The stock market historically has returned, 6 to 7% after inflation. So just putting your money in the market and leaving there is great. Now, as a retiree, right, where we're relying on that money for our income, we can't put 100% of our money there. That is way too volatile for most people to sleep at night. So you need to have it hedged with something else that doesn't move as crazy. Traditionally, that has been bonds. But the last 15 years or so, really since 2009, when quantitative easing started happening, the bond market has been very artificial. And so in order to get any kind of returns in bonds, you had to go after what's called junk bonds, which, well, if I told you what they are, you would go running for the hills. The best analogy I can think of is giving your deadbeat uncle some money, right? You don't want to do that.
No, we don't.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's not that bad, but you are chasing returns. You're essentially loaning money to people who can't get ordinary loans, or they're asking for large amounts and they have a lot of risk, which means the value can go down at any time, right? People sour on the economy, it goes down, which I think brings us to another thing that we do need to talk about, which is, what is the market and what is inflation based on, right? Because we're talking about protecting ourselves from this and, we can protect it by putting it in the stock market. We can protect it by, putting in bonds. We can buy insurance policies that have inflation adjustments on them. We can get other contracts that have inflation adjustments on them. But at the end of the day, right, if we don't understand what's happening to us, we're going to be scared about all of this stuff no matter what, right? And we're just going to be reading the headlines going, I don't understand what's going on, but it scares me, right?
So what about the perception? How does our perception play into inflation? It seems as if we can control it to a certain degree as with, I call it groupthink. Is that a possibility or does it even work that way?
So it absolutely works that way. So there are what I call, soft and hard reasons for inflation, right? So we've got the hard reasons are, supply and demand. We don't have enough goods. And so more money is chasing those goods because people still want their stuff, right? So let's take, electronics, right? COVID hit, a factory shut down, people wanted more electronics. So not only did demand go up in terms of what we wanted, but the supply went down, which is like just a killer from manufacturing and economics, which drives the price up. And then we have disruptions in the supply chain. So even if we wanted to ramp up, we couldn't, and we couldn't get the goods to where they needed to go. So all of this means that people are willing to pay more money for the same goods, right? So that is typical inflation. Mm-hmm. Now, there is another type of inflation that happens, which is when people believe that something about the future, we have this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that happens. So if I believe that the economy is going to go down in the future, and enough people believe that, it has power to actually make it happen, even if all the fundamentals are sound, right? Now, there is a certain amount of, with inflation and with the stock market, that if people believe and they experience this, even if it is transitory, even if these supply issues return to normal, that the price won't return to normal. And that this inflation that we've experienced will be permanent because people believe it to be the new normal. And so we got to be really careful about that. So even though you may hear on the news that people are saying, well, this is transitory, it's just going to go away, when it comes to our finances, we can't plan like that. Because the reality is that when it comes to how much we're going to pay for goods, mm-hmm. well, you know, the grocery store is getting more money, Apple's making more money. Right? Everyone's making more money. They're not going to want to give that up just because there's more supply, unless the supply increases dramatically more than demand.
Libel, we're just about out of time, but I'm just curious. Do you think we'll ever go back to pre-pandemic levels with regard to price rollbacks and inflation and so forth?
I don't think, at least in terms of inflation, I think that we'll have some of it roll back, but not a significant amount.
All right. And as we're talking about this, as we have to leave this topic too soon, in my opinion, what should we really think about as we look at inflation and our investments?
You need to have a plan. You need to have a plan for how your money is going to grow to keep pace or outpace inflation. Because if you don't have a plan, then you are going to lose money and you're going to turn around one day and go, why can't I live the lifestyle I've been living up until now?
Well, that's some sage advice. Thank you, Libel. We look forward to hearing from you again next week. Libel's website is libelonfire.com. That's libelonfire.com. Hey, everybody, I'm Freddie Bell. It's great that you're with us this weekend on New Beginnings. And right now it's time for our week in review. Number one at the top of the list, Russia and the United States clashed over the Ukraine, a crisis during a United Nations Security Council meeting this past Monday. Russia wants the United States and its allies to bar Ukraine from joining NATO as a condition for easing tensions. But the United States and NATO have ruled that out. Also, the Food and Drug Administration has given full approval for Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. The drug Spikevax is the second coronavirus vaccine to become fully licensed in the United States. The Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine was the first, receiving full FDA approval back in August. Also on Monday, Maryland-based Novavax submitted its long-awaited application for emergency use authorization for its vaccine. Novavax vaccine is made differently than the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, which use messenger RNA to provoke an immune system response to the virus. Novavax shot is a protein vaccine, delivering nanoparticles of the coronavirus spike protein to get the immune system to attack the infection. And Spotify stock is rebounding from a plunge triggered by allegations that podcast host Joe Rogan was spreading COVID-19 misinformation. The shares had dropped from $193.56 a share as of last week and has rebounded by about $2. Rogan apologized for his comments and promised to do better. Spotify is saying that it's adding content advisories to COVID-centered episodes of the Joe Rogan Experience, a key show in its bid to expand beyond music. Former President Trump is rejecting a proposal pushed by outside advisors, notably lawyers Sidney Powell, Michael Flynn, and Phil Waldron, to have Pentagon seize voting machines in a handful of swing states President Biden won. The former president also directed his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to ask the Department of Homeland Security whether it could do so. These new accounts by people with first or secondhand knowledge of the events show that Trump was more directly involved than previously known in exploring proposals to use his national security agencies to seize voting machines in his push to reverse his election loss, that according to the New York Times. And tributes are pouring in for former Miss USA Chesley Crist after her death. She was an extra correspondent and former Miss USA who died in a fall from her New York City apartment building on Sunday. She was 30 years old, received a law degree from Wake Forest University after completing her undergraduate studies at the University of South Carolina, where she ran track. Her death, which is being investigated as a suicide, left former colleagues, fans, and those who knew her from her charity work stunned and deeply sad. A number of well wishes are coming in from all over the country for the former Miss USA. And that's our weekend review on New Beginnings. I'm Freddie Bell. Join us each week at this time for information you can use on a daily basis. I'm Freddie Bell, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to New Beginnings. New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Good morning, everyone. Hello. Happy weekend to you. Glad you're with us this weekend on New Beginnings. I'm Freddie Bell, and with us right now is Mr. Joe McKenzie. He is the founder of Ripple Connects. He has that knack of turning candidates into contenders, and he helps people, his clients, to develop that contender mindset. And he'll talk about that later on, if not today, in a future program. Joe McKenzie, good morning and welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Freddie Bell. How are you today?
Unbelievable. And I know that I've been saying this for a long time, that we're one day closer to spring. So I'm excited about that.
We are. We're entering February now, and you know we're well on our way to seeing spring flowers here soon.
Absolutely. And this weekend, we're talking about the challenge of changing careers. And this is a time you mentioned a few weeks ago that we're getting ready for the hiring season, and we need to make the appropriate preparations in order to really leverage and take advantage of those employers who are looking for new talent, or maybe you're trying to get a promotion where you are right now. So we want to talk about the challenge of changing careers at any age, particularly if you're in the second half of your career. What makes it more difficult for a person to change careers if they're midway through their entire career?
I think it's two-sided. One of it, it's ourselves thinking that we're only meant to do one type of job and the skills needed for that, but also the workforce, the people in the workforce and the hiring capacity, not seeing our transferable skills, not seeing the value that we bring, because we may be a different type of candidate they've interviewed before. And I can speak firsthand. I've changed careers a couple times over. So I've experienced this. Why would you want to go from the office equipment industry to the nonprofit? And so I speak firsthand about the challenges that I saw, but also that still exist today. So it's really both the individual knowing that they may not have the skills to make a change in their careers, and maybe the hiring component are not asking the right questions of someone that has a different background than they've normally hired. It's twofold, in my opinion.
Everyone, we're talking with Joe McKenzie this weekend about the challenge of changing careers. I know when I've thought about changing careers over the years, Joe McKenzie, I thought, oh my goodness, I've got to take assessment and a self-evaluation of where I am, what my skill sets might be, and then try to package that in a way to get ready. But I've heard you say that if we're looking at changing careers, it may not be like next week. So maybe are there some preparation steps that we can take right now to get ready for that time?
Absolutely. And I do think, and I've said this for several years on New Beginnings, your bench of career advocates, those people that know you the best, that have seen you in action, your leadership, your soft skills, your the personality type, the motivation you bring to the workforce, they're going to help you bring some clarity to where you could transfer to, go into. And so you have to bring your advocates close. If you're just going to, it's just going to be you and your computer, my guess, and to do that type of search, my guess is there's going to be some gaps in there. That bench of career advocates are going to help fill some of those gaps. And even your greater professional network, if you ripple it out from there, might give you that insight to say, hey, this industry is looking for someone like you. You know, I've heard some of the people that have transferred from the healthcare field, they make great sales professionals. The reason they make great sales professionals because they're good listeners. They're good at asking questions. Well, that's what a good salesperson does, right? And so most people don't think that way. But when we start thinking about the transferable skills we have and we engage with people that already know us, then it doesn't seem so imposing as what you mentioned, taking the assessment, where are you at, where do I go? Bring more people, more sets of eyes and ears into the equation, and you will move it past it seeming like you can't get this done to, oh, I never thought about that. Oh, I never considered that industry. That's why you need to pull your network close. And also, Freddie, you have to effectively communicate why you're making a change. No one said that you had to stay in one industry your entire career, right?
Correct.
Well, state your why. Why are you changing? Why are you going from this to that? And that will also help your bench of advocates and your greater professional network as they talk to others, explain your why. So you take away some of that mystery that, well, why would anybody want to make that type of change? Well, it's because we don't have to have the same career for 40 years anymore. We can divide it up. We can do what we want. And we do have transferable skills. So those are two strategies. Engage with your professional network, you know, starting with your bench career advocates that know you the best and let it ripple from there. But also be ready to explain why you're doing it.
Everyone, Joe McKenzie with us this weekend. And that's one side of it. What about the other side, the more fundamental piece of it? Applying online, navigating through the checkboxes and the radio buttons and so forth, making sure that you've got a camera for an interview. What about that part of being ready to make a career transition?
And you do have to be ready, and you have to be ready to the traditional job search methods. If you are not going to engage with your professional network and explaining your why, and you're going to apply for jobs, often you're not going to have all that what they're looking for. Okay. So you have to be aware of that. Applying online does not ensure that you get an interview. They may look at salary expectations because you're changing from one industry to another. There may be some obstacles out there that you should be aware of. So if your strategy is solely to change careers just by applying for different types of jobs and not take those steps that we talked about a few minutes ago, you have to, A, you have to be aware of it, and have to be to confront that. You're going to have to find ways to get to the interview stage so you can explain your why, talk about your transfer skills, about some of the challenges of this industry. If you can't get to that point, it's going to be tough when you're applying just for advertised jobs from your home computer.
Well, that home computer is something else. It's your virtual office. What about when employers want to talk about salary expectations? I know there are a lot of folks who really cringe at that particular conversation.
I think you should be aware of what different industries' expectations are for salaries. There's enough online tools out there to determine, even down to the state of Minnesota, just what expectations are in the healthcare field and the nonprofit field, in education and IT and construction. I think you have to do your own due diligence on that. Talk to others, but also be realistic. And if you've had a high level title in the past and you're looking to maybe pull back on your career or do different things, explain that, because maybe you're not seeking that salary that you had in this industry. That does have to be, you do have to prepare for that. But go into that with that knowledge of salary expectations in each of these industries so you're not caught off guard with that question.
So there are two barriers that we just outlined. One about getting ready and using your professional network, other the online, the technical aspects of career seeking. But sometimes there could be an issue, and you've outlined it in your notes here this weekend, about overcoming self-limiting thoughts, Joe McKenzie.
Yes, and that happens more than we'd like to think, and it's happened to me. What value do I do bring that nonprofit sector? What value do I do bring to this sector? And I think that happens because we're getting way out of our comfort zone by going to do a different job. And once again, engaging with the people that you know, talking about your transferable skills, seeing how they're going to be applying in these industries, that helps overcome that self-limiting thinking that you may have about that change. And I've coached many people to say that, have that conversation with someone that you know about that. And it's a granular approach to overcoming that thinking, Freddie. You have to build upon it. It's not a one-off. It's not one article you read. It's a series of conversations. And when you have better clarity on what some of these industries are up against, meaning the challenges and what they need to accomplish, and then know how your existing skills can transfer or your leadership and communication can help move the needle in those areas, then that self-limiting thinking starts to go, you know, slowly go away.
So if you were to outline those things that we should consider as we're looking to change careers or to start a brand new one, what would they be for our audience this weekend?
Be conscious of the overall traditional job search methods. And if you're just going to apply for advertised jobs and not have that wherewithal to have conversations on why and salary expectations and why you're changing, you may get frustrated. And that's why you pull in your professional network to have those conversations, to overcome some of that self-limited thinking that you may have, and just refine your why. Why are you doing this? And that starts with your network, and that can transfer into that conversation with the employers.
Joe, you do some fine work at Ripple Connect, sir.
Yes, we do. We turn candidates into contenders.
Well, that's our show for this week. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. Thank you for making us a part of your weekend experience. And here are today's words to the wise. You can only do what you can do. Today's words to the wise read, you can only do what you can do. Those words are found in my brand new book entitled Words to the Wise, available at FreddieBell.com or on Amazon. For everyone who's been a part of this one, this is Freddie Bell reminding you that every day is a chance for a new beginning.